that deep values, which are a part of the United States, and how those deep values impact how we think of ourselves in relationship to health and other things that we consume. And key among those, it seems to us, are questions of individual liberty and choice, the kind of freedom that is dear to American citizens, and the idea that our lives are in pursuit of happiness, that we have a kind of framing of our constitutional documents, the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence, that construe what a human life is. So those kinds of deep values play into this question. And they play into the way that the debate is happening nationally, especially with the election campaign heating up this fall. And we also have, as a part of our deep culture, care for the neighbor, care for community, care for the stranger. It's something that I think is embedded in the Statue of Liberty poem by Emma Lazarus: "Give us your tired, your poor, your huddled masses." So we have these tensions between caring for the neighbor and caring for the one in need, and at the same time wanting to focus on our own pursuit of happiness. And those tensions play out in the values that are a part of the healthcare debate. So tonight what we want to aim for is to understand better some of the circumstances that are a part of this debate about healthcare reform. And through doing that, to be better informed as citizens, as Christian citizens, who will be a part of the common debate this fall, and give us all resources for framing those debates in ways that we see to be constructive and supportive of what we most hope for. And so with that introduction, I'll hand it over to you. Thanks for agreeing to do this with us.
So I think Peter and I see this as a conversation, not a presentation. So we'll just set the stage by framing some of the issues. So my name is Maren, and I am a physician. I'm a general internist. I work at Cambridge Hospital in Massachusetts, which is one of the sort of small public hospital teaching affiliates of Harvard Medical School. And I'm not a health policy analyst or health policy scholar, and I am not a theologian, but I am a Christian, and I've been actively wrestling with, I think, the messages that I believe are fundamental Christian theological messages about health and healing, and its relationship between the healthcare industry that I work in. So the hymn that we close with in Vespers is a great example of the metaphor of health and healing, which is central to our Christian tradition and central to the language that we use to think about what it means to be human and what it means to live in community, what our responsibilities are to God and to one another. So there's a lot of ways in which this metaphor about healing and wholeness and abundant life are central to the Christian story. And I'm struck with the way in which my professional life as a physician is also dedicated to that mission in some ways, but the tools, the technology, the language, the culture, the assumptions of my workplace, which is the hospital, are different than the assumptions of the Christian story related to healing. And so I've been reflecting this week on the tensions in the different ways that the healthcare system and the Christian story frame this vision about health and healing. I think that one of the contrasts is that healing in the Bible is not a consumer good. Health is not for sale in the Bible. It is not. There's no health place marketplace. There's no health marketplace, basically, in the Bible. And very much the world that I work in as a professional healthcare provider is a marketplace. And it operates under the logic of the capitalist marketplace. And so there is, as Chris mentioned, advertising and business plans, and there's a lot of money in this sector, which is the healthcare sector. And so there are haves and have-nots, and there are winners and losers, and you don't have access to health care in the way that everybody has access to the healing power of God in the biblical story. So one of the things that I'm struck with is the role of the marketplace in the way in which we think about the good that we're delivering. And in the logic of the marketplace, the notion of the kind of consumer choices and consumer preferences is very important. And so there is in the debate, in the current debate in the public discourse about the Affordable Care Act, there is sort of an assumption that health is like any other consumer good, that you should be able to choose to buy it if you want to. And so a lot of the vehemence that has been directed against the Affordable Care Act is focused on this notion that the government is telling individual people what to buy. And I think there are limits to the framing of health as a marketplace good, because of course illness is not really something we choose. And so we're not in a position to choose not to choose a response to illness. And so it's not like a pair of shoes or a car or a house, in that it's not really, since pain and suffering and illness and disease and death are a fundamental part of the human experience, we actually don't have the opportunity to choose not to participate in that need. And so, consequently, it's a funny marketplace, and the marketplace metaphor, nobody's really truly comfortable with when push comes to shove. So if you're riding your motorcycle and you don't have health insurance, and you are in an accident, and the ambulance brings you to the emergency department, there is no public consensus that the emergency department should choose not to respond to this need. We actually fundamentally believe that when somebody is in need, if somebody is short of breath, if somebody is bleeding, if somebody is clutching their chest, if somebody has broken their leg, they actually deserve, just because of their intrinsic dignity as human beings, they deserve a response. And so it's never going to operate as a true marketplace, this domain of human need and the response that, as a society, we actually want to be able to offer. So I think there's that fundamental tension.
We actually have that consensus in the society because it's illegal for an emergency room to turn somebody away. So to that extent, you know, there's been broad consensus that they have to do that.
Mm-hmm. I'll briefly talk sort of a little bit. For those of you who know Sam Bardwell and Martha Schwain, I'm Sam and Martha's brother-in-law. For those of you who don't know them, the R.C. or non-R.C. So my name is Petter, and I teach religion at St. Louis College. And this week I've been dealing sort of with Christian practices sort of in a consumptive, market-based world context. And there's a couple things I think, at least from my perspective, I would sort of frame the issue with that partially piggyback with what Maureen's talking about. And one is, the way I started this week, I started out with the idea that we are restless creatures. We are not whole. there's a missing part, or there's a thirst, there's a hunger. There's parts of us that we aren't the person we want to be, nor are we the person God wants us to be. And because we live in a market-based economy, and we're trained to think sort of consumptively and to choose, often we try and fill that restlessness with things in the world. And I think because of that, and in that underlying restlessness, and we live in a very wealthy, prosperous society, full of lots of fun computers and phones and clothes and shopping malls, that in some ways it's overwhelming. But I think we've also turned that sort of reality of that restlessness on our own bodies. And it's not clear to me today what health is. I know one of the roots of the theological concept of salvation is a salve, which itself is related to our concept of health. And for the most part, theologically, when we talk about things like salvation, what are we talking about? Your relationship with God that eventually moves you into heaven once you are dead. And too often, I think the sort of the dominant theological tradition ignores the physical nature of salvation. What might it mean to be saved physically? And how might that relate to any type of market-based healthcare program in which the hope is that you were then able to work on preventative care for each other amidst the community? So there's that element of restlessness that I think plays into sort of the idea of our bodies. And I think part of that idea in the marketplace in particular is the idea of physical perfection. That I think really makes the idea of what healthiness is complex. I mean, I have scoliosis. Am I healthy? Well, I have back problems. Should I go get it checked out? Well, probably. But does it really impact my quality of life right now? Not so much. But where do you draw the line? Where do you start thinking about exactly what health is? And how is it informed by this sort of consumptive mentality that in a lot of ways is coming out of this restlessness, that we're not the people that God wants us to be? That's one piece in terms of how I frame it. Another has to do with, I think, the tension, and Chris sort of alluded to it, between sort of the embeddedness of our relationality, in which Christ has called us to be in community with each other. And in the ideal world, there is this harmony between love of self and love of the neighbor, in which your neighbor and you both have equal access to education, equal access to well-paying jobs, equal access to clean air and water, and equal access to health care. But in the real world, the ideal is such that even in a place like Holden, not everyone sort of is as responsible as one should be. That they're not really living up to that connection, that balance between myself, between the neighbor and myself, that harmony in terms of how we treat. So we have all these different expectations about what one deserves, what one's responsible for, how should I help the neighbor when the neighbor really doesn't seem to be trying to help themselves. And frankly, at some point, and you think about healthcare, smoking, alcoholism, driving a motorcycle without a helmet. Now, these are good people, but why are they doing that? They know they're not supposed to. We know in our society that there's a link between smoking and certain forms of cancer. So I wouldn't want to do that to myself. Why are they doing it to themselves? So in some ways, there's this judgment that we then sort of, or there's at least a tension between this ideal we have of, okay, we all are part of this community, and we do live relationally, and we're embedded in these kinds of relationships. But at the same time, there are certain people who really don't live up to the standards that are clear and obvious to most of us. What are they doing? And I think in terms of, you know, what Christian practice is, obviously there are issues of sin and brokenness in there, but I think it's a real then struggle to figure out ways to talk about this without getting caught up in that messiness and that gray area and those frustrations. And frankly, I think part of the political debate we are experiencing is a lot of that messiness. You know, the government shouldn't be doing this because everyone should be responsible. They should live up to the same standards that I have. It's their fault. They're choosing wrongly. And in reality, I don't think that comes out of a very Christian ethos, but there is that recognition that we are broken and we are imperfect and we are never the person God wants us to be. But some people, frankly, don't keep up their end of the bargain. And, you know, in many ways, I'm not sure where to go with these kinds of gray areas and these tensions. That's the frame that I hope we can at least talk a little bit about tonight.
Just one more comment before we open it up. So I think that the notion of the healthcare marketplace, which governs the way we think about our health policy, is in a place of crisis because this insatiable demand for bodily perfection that is a part of our consumer culture. And so we have gotten to a place where, as a country, we spend more money per capita on our health care system than any other industrialized country in the world by an order of magnitude. I think I've heard statistics like we spend over half of all the healthcare dollars in the world in this country. And we spend, you know, so we spend almost $9,000 per person per year on healthcare, and the next closest country is maybe Norway, and they spend like $5,500 or something. So we're really we're spending almost twice what the next most wealthy country in the world spends per capita on healthcare. And we're not actually getting wellness. We're not getting well-being. We're not living longer. We're not more productive. We don't miss less days of work because of poor health. Our health disparities are greater than they are in many other countries. So the difference between the least well and the most well is more dramatic. So despite all this money that we're spending and this apparently insatiable desire that we have as a country for wellness, we haven't created a system that's producing a lot of wellness. Yeah.
Where's the money going then? Where is it?
Yeah, what's the breakdown?
75% of all healthcare dollars are spent in the last year someone's left.
Was a figure released by CMS within the last month. So 75% of that money doesn't in fact go to wellness. It goes to our issues with allowing a normal ends in circles, I guess.
I think we need to have more conversations about dying and death. In my own situation with my mom, she was really at a point where she was very much talking about medical. And she had a major event where she was having assisted living and staff went and she had aspirated. I was at the airport leaving, got a call saying your mom's phone unresponsive and we're sending her to the hospital. And what I didn't know in that is that you have to have a do not transport in addition to all the do nots. And so they said we're required by law to transport her. And so the next thing I'm doing is getting on the phone at the University of Minnesota begging to get a doctor. And they said, yes, your mom's arrived. The doctors are working on her. And I'm going, no, this is not what she wanted. And because I knew it would be, you know, kind of probably pneumonia. They, you know, do the full spiel. So I persisted. Finally, the doctor came on the phone and explained to him where my mom was at. And I said, she is ready to go. She's very much ready to go. And I was saying angry at the, not knowing that we needed to have a do not transport in addition to all that. And so he was godsend. I mean, I'm convinced of that, because he said, I know exactly where you're at. I have the same situation with my own parent. He didn't know about the Do Not Transport. And he said, we will just make your mom comfortable. We won't do anything, you know, life extending, and take your time to get to the hospital. Don't, you know, it's rush hour and all that. So it was so, and it was so funny, because once we got to the hospital, then they brought the palliative team in, which were wonderful. And I thought, where was that palliative team in the very beginning? You know, they should have been there with the emergency team that was, you know, that started doing, you know, having a discussion with the new doc. I'm not sure it was good. But it's treatment, 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 you know. And when I was nursing in pediatrics, I had many ethical dilemmas, because it was always, let's try one more thing. And families were so ready to just go home and let their child, you know, die at peace. So it's the whole conversation on death and quality of dying that we need to have a much bigger conversation about, because we don't want to go there.
Yeah, I think that's certainly, and that's a very important role for the church to play, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think churches are full of people who have never had conversations about their own wishes with the people in their own family. And so it's actually relatively uncommon for me to encounter a patient in the hospital that has ever had a conversation with the people they love about dying,
mm-hmm.
even though it's really clear that they're nearing the end of their lives. And it is the case that it's the inability to talk and think and feel around the end of life that leads to a lot of expense and technology and intervention, and you know, it's a manifestation of our denial about that, for sure. But that's not the whole story for why our healthcare system is as expensive as it is. I think that is definitely, you know, in the pie chart. There's a slice that is related to the way that we encounter death as a society. I don't know how different it is in other industrialized countries. I don't know. So I'm not sure if that explains why we are so, why we spend so much more money than in other countries, because I think it's sort of part of the human experience to be uncomfortable about dying. So we're pretty hardwired in that way. So I don't know how American that is, but I think there are some very specific ways probably in which we have a cult of denial around death, which is probably a little bit more intense than here than in some places. But I think there are other features of our healthcare system that make it expensive. And one of them has, yeah. So I think that we have a very, our commitment to research and development and technologies is very intense.
Mm-hmm.
And so we, much of the healthcare dollar goes into new technologies and new drugs. And because these are growth industries for our economy, there's a lot of new drugs on the marketplace and new technologies and new surgeries. And so that's a big driver of our cost. And I think we're unusual in that way. And then our healthcare system is very expensive because of the role that our faith in the marketplace plays. So we're very committed to private insurance, and that's a huge slice of our pie. So Medicaid and Medicare are much cheaper to administer than Blue Cross or Cigna or any of the large private health insurance industries. And so we've got the experience of the healthcare provider is that you have to manage relationships with all of these different third-party payers, and each third-party payer has their own infrastructure, which costs money, and their own staff, and then healthcare systems, delivery systems, need to have lots of staff to manage the billing process, the coding process, and the way in which they maximize their revenue from all of these different insurance companies. So we have a huge slice of our healthcare dollar which is related to the administration of the finances of our healthcare system. Whereas in a single payer system, you don't even have to have a billing office. It just that is taken care of. So that's a huge piece of our healthcare dollar.
Our healthcare system supports another industry,
yes,
which is insurance.
Which is the industry, yes.
So we're paying for this other business.
I once worked in a system that had to be prepared to prepare a bill for the same service 125 different ways. That's not free. That's stupid.
I think the other piece of this consumerism and sort of marketplaces, so the hospital I work at is in downtown St. Paul. Well, right in the middle of downtown St. Paul, there are just a myriad of hospitals with way too many hospital beds, and it's so there's just no overall planning because we just leave it to the marketplace to plan what we need, and that becomes a really confusing system for consumers to use, and so it becomes expensive. I see it all the time. I work in a federally qualified health center, and people come for their prenatal care, and so they get registered with us, and we do all these labs, and maybe they get an ultrasound, but, then they get home in the middle of the night, they don't feel well. Well, what hospital is that? So they go to a different one, that's a different hospital. They get the same labs, they get another ultrasound. They get, maybe they're overnight for this or that, and pretty soon they've shopped at many different hospitals, and there's just this redundancy of sort of competition instead of overall plans, really. And so just even on small things, it shouldn't really be that expensive. It reduces the cost way up. And that doesn't even count the human cost, right? Confusion and poor care. And so I think that's not like the marketplace messes it all up.
I think there's also a conflict in the worlds. And in some ways, your question, Ian. Modern medicine comes out of a different world than the Christian tradition. I mean, if you look at the Bible talks about Jesus as a healer, miracles are possible. Jesus walks on water. As far as I know, none of us have had those kinds of experiences. And in some ways, the Bible presents this world as a God sort of in charge, and ultimately, God gives and God takes away. And the way this country sort of was founded, it was founded with a real skepticism towards religion. Because what do religions do? They fight. If you look at the European experience, I lived in Poland for a while, the Swedish Lutherans came down all the time and they would take everything they could from Poland and then Poland would go to Sweden. And that the people who founded this country tried to find ways to limit the role of religion in public discourse. And what that has done, I think, has sort of created a vacuum. One of the vacuum is, like, we don't know how to talk about death as a culture. We don't know how to talk about health as a culture because they're value-laden terms. So we end up doing this sort of least common denominator when we use those concepts. And I think because of that, partially, that science has sort of stepped in. And here you have these doctors who are well-trained, they're smart, they are tasked with the care for the body, and that's their job. I think when I first met Maren, she was like, I'm here to talk about healing, but I don't consider myself a healer. I'm not really sure what that means for a doctor. Healing, in some ways, is a religious term. And you're a doctor. You're trying to make sure the body is whole. But that's it, the body. And all these other factors, partially because we don't know how to study them, or they're, and I don't know. They're not really observable in the same way that the body is. Especially the mechanistic idea of the body, which sort of informed modern science, that, why do we move? Because the muscle does something, and we're like little robots, and there's the soul inside of us that causes us to move. And so what do we do as doctors?